Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on understanding limited liability when we come back. You know, the income tax and Social Security programs are not compatible with our traditional American values, and that's because these two programs are the second and eighth planks of the Communist Manifesto. These programs call for a heavy progressive income tax in place of tithing. Social Security is a social welfare scheme that takes the place of strict liability and individual responsibility. The income tax requires of us that we serve two masters in violation of Matthew 6:24. The income tax requires of us that we rob God in violation of Malachi 3, verse 8. The income tax requires of us that we commit idolatry in violation of Exodus 20, verse 3. The income tax requires of us that we use unjust weights and balances in violation of Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. And the income tax requires of us that we sign contracts with these foreign and alien gods in violation of Exodus 23, verses 32 and 33. Social Security violates the strict liability statute in Exodus 21, verses 28 through 36. Social Security violates the 10th commandment by appealing to our lust and greed. Then we're taught to call that income redistribution. The scripture calls it covetousness in violation of Exodus 20, verse 17. Now, you know, the God of Israel gave us a better way of life than that, and our founding fathers followed that better way of life. That's why I contend that you and I ought to learn how to practice that better way. If you'd like more information about tax and status, call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. While you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. Remember, it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free. Now, tax and status, our school, is available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, click onto the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. That's georgegordon.org. All right, we've been talking about limited liability. Limited liability is insurance. Insurance violates the Ten Commandments, specifically the Tenth Commandment, and it violates the statute in Exodus 21, verses 28 through 36. We were told not to do it, but then, of course, we're a little bit smarter than God. But as I pointed out, there are some side effects that most of us never take into consideration. There are limitations on our freedoms that is caused by a guardian-ward relationship that is established because we sign a contract which brings us under Article 1, Section 8 of our Constitution called the Commerce Clause. Then we're being regulated and controlled under the Commerce Clause, and we just complain like hell that government and government agencies are interfering with our God-given rights, which is true. But you invited them in. And you invited them in because you wanted these benefits. And under Social Security, there's 108 of them. Now, you want these 108 benefits. They are old age and survivor's benefits, unemployment insurance, workman's compensation. There's many of them that you probably wouldn't even know how to collect. And because you want these benefits, they have to be paid for. Government does not have any money. The money that government has, they have to get from you, or they have to borrow on your credit card. Government doesn't have any wealth whatsoever, but they do have power. They have power over your wealth because you gave them your power of attorney. And as I pointed out earlier, these contracts that we make with banks, insurance companies, government, employers, unions, lawyers, doctors, hospitals, schools, colleges, and so on, these contracts give your power of attorney to these institutions. And when you sign your power of attorney over, you create a guardian-ward relationship in which now you have a master-servant relationship. It's called feudal serfdom in the Middle Ages today. We call it national socialism. So what we have is a fascist socialist government that is providing for us in the same way that the Middle Ages provided for the kings and the institutions of their day. The king has a duty now to provide labor for all of his earls and dukes and barons. And in the United States, what we're doing is we're doing the same thing, but we don't call them earls and dukes and sheiks. We call them states, counties, and corporations. And the people aren't called feudal serfs. They're called employees. And we have the same guardian-ward relationship that we had in the Middle Ages, except that we've changed the name. Makes us feel a lot better. Now, once in a while, we get some good news about these insurance companies. Let me tell you a little story here about some good news that came out of Ketchikan, Alaska, concerning Lloyd's of London back in the 1970s. Now, Lloyd's of London is the biggest, most powerful insurance company in the world, and actually, they're not an insurance company. They're organized in such a way that they're called something else. I forgot what the name is now. They're actually underwriters, but not, strictly speaking, an insurance company. But they perform the same service. And they one time insured a restaurant in Ketchikan, Alaska for $250,000, and the restaurant burned down. And the owner of the restaurant put in a claim. He said, okay, my restaurant burned down, pay me my $250,000. And for some reason, Lloyd's decided, no, we're not going to do that. Now, it's kind of unusual because $250,000 to Lloyd's of London doesn't even make a dust on the accountant's ledger. The Lloyd's people don't even report losses that are less than $100 million. To get a report out of Lloyd's that says, hey, we lost some money, it's got to be $100 million or more. And $250,000 doesn't even come up on the radar screen. So for whatever reason, I don't know the reason, but they said, no, we're not going to pay this. So the owner of the restaurant brought legal action against Lloyd's and said, yeah, you need to pay for this. So the Lloyd's people dug in, and they brought criminal action against the owner of the restaurant, charged him with arson, burned your own restaurant down, did you? We're going to fix you. So the case wound its way through the courts, and this guy could prove that he didn't burn his restaurant down. And he was exonerated. And so the case went to trial, and he won, and Lloyd's appealed, and the case went up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, we don't think that the amount of money that's been awarded here, I think it was around $10 million, is anywhere near enough, and they upped it to $100 million. Now, there's only one other case that I know of or have heard of where the Supreme Court has added punitive damages onto a damages award because of the egregious behavior of one of these corporations. The second one was the Sears Company. The Sears Company had a wrench of some kind. I think it was a socket wrench, and it has a push button on it. And this guy invented this wrench, and you push the button and the socket falls off. And when you don't push the button, well, then the socket stays on. It doesn't fall off. A pretty good invention. It's a pretty good tool. I think I've got one in my toolbox. And the Sears Company cheated this guy out of his money. They made a deal with him to market the product, and then they cheated him out of it. And so he sued him, and I think he collected somewhere in the neighborhood of $17 to $20 million. And I think Sears appealed, and they took it to the Supreme Court. And when the Supreme Court got through, they doubled it to $40 million, you know, or numbers thereabouts. They doubled the award, which is similar to what they did to Lloyd's of London. Now, that doesn't happen very often. I mean, that's like winning the lottery when that happens. But it demonstrates something that's pretty fundamental about these big corporations. For practical purposes, they just have unlimited funds. It's like fighting with the government. When you take on a legal case against the government is funded by you through your taxes. And then you have to go in and do battle by funding your side of the case with your own money. What it boils down to is that when you go into the courtroom, you, Mr. Taxpayer, you, Mr. Citizen, are actually funding both sides of the litigation. I know it sounds kind of crazy, but that's the way the game is played. So I just want to tell you that since you're paying for the other side, 100 cents on the dollar, it makes sense that on your side you want to do it as cheap as possible. So if you can avoid hiring a lawyer and do the case pro se, you can do a case from the scene of the crime to the U.S. Supreme Court for about $2,000 on your side. You'll have to pay full bore to pay the other side on their side. That's you're doing through your taxes. That's you and all of your neighbors out there chipping up your money for the express purpose of prosecuting you. You get to pay both sides. I know it sounds kind of crazy, but that's the way the game is played. Now, it kind of reminds me of a story on the other side of the coin that occurred in Ferndale, California about 1950. The volunteer fire department got a call one day, and there was a hedge fire. Now, these hedges were windbreaks, and they were grown back in the early days, back in the 1860s, 70s, and 80s, when the valley was first settled. The old-timers would plant these, it wasn't spruce, and it wasn't cedar. It was some other kind of tree that grows along the coast there. But anyway, it grows up, and it's pretty fast growing, and it's an evergreen, you know, kind of like a spruce tree or a fir tree, cedar tree. Anyway, a cypress. I think it was a cypress. And the thing grows up, and it provides a windbreak. Well, anyway, as the years go by, it develops a lot of dead wood inside this hedge. And over the years, this hedge, which had been planted underneath the power lines, grew up through the power lines, and the PG&E company was supposed to come out and cut the wood, the dead wood, away from their power lines, but they didn't do that. And these hedges would stretch out for, in some cases, 2 or 3 miles. And in this particular hedge, the power lines were buried inside the hedge, And the fire department guys got out there. These guys are not real professionals. They're probably pretty well trained. They're volunteer firemen, and they got fire trucks and ladders and all the equipment. Well, anyway, as it turned out, the power lines started a fire in this hedge. So somebody called the fire department. They came out there, and these two guys, they get out there to the end of it, and they throw a ladder, aluminum ladder, up into the hedge, and they start climbing up there. Well, the ladder hits this hidden power line and electrocutes both of them, kills them dead. So that being the case, it was a clear-cut case of wrongful death on the part of PG&E. PG&E knew or should have known that that wire was in the hedge and it was a hazard, and they're the one that caused the fire, and these two guys were killed, and they needed to be paid. So PG&E has insurance. And the insurance company sits down with the two widows of these two guys, and this is about 1950 now, and they offered these widows $1 million, $500,000 each. Now, in 1950, that was quite a bit of money. And if you multiplied it out in today's dollars, multiplied that times 10, it would be about $5 million in purchasing power each for those two widows. The widows didn't want $500,000. They said they wanted $1 million. Now, this is what we call in law an open and shut case. There is a clear-cut rule of law that is involved here. The facts speak for themselves. In fact, the insurance company and the power company's willingness to settle in an out-of-court settlement for what appears to be a very tidy sum, $500,000 each, demonstrated to everybody that the power company and insurance company recognized they were in the wrong and needed to pay. So all we're arguing over here is the amount. Nobody is in a disagreement as to the liability. The plaintiffs, those that have been wronged, the legal system and process, the insurance company, the power company, everybody's in agreement. We're in the wrong, and we're going to pay, and here's how much we're offering you. But the ladies decided they didn't want to take that amount, and they wanted to sue, and they wanted $1 million each, and they thought that the jury would award $1 million, and so they went to trial. And the trial was about 6 weeks, and they produced all witnesses, evidence, and testimony, put on a hell of a good case, and of course the insurance company comes back, and they're there to defend, aren't they? And so is the power company. And of course in the process, the jury learns that they've been offered $500,000 each. Now remember, in a case like this, the insurance company and the power company are never going to pay this $1 million or $2 million out of their pockets. The rate payers are going to pay that. The rate payers. It is the people who buy the electricity who are paying the insurance premiums. It's not PG&E that pays the insurance premium. That cost is merely passed on to the rate payers. The insurance company is never going to pay out any money to anybody for any cause or reason. The amount of money that's paid out at the claims window is programmed into the program in the collection of the premiums. So anything that's paid out first had to be collected in the premiums. And so the people of the Eel River Valley who buy the electricity from PG&E are ultimately the people who are going to pay these damages of $2 million. And now these two ladies have come to the rate payers, the jury, and said, we want you to assess yourselves $2 million because we're not satisfied with $500,000. So the jury goes into deliberations, and they came back and awarded these two ladies $1 each. $1. Which should send a message to everybody. The story of the golden goose comes into play here, doesn't it? Now, they were offered a reasonable settlement, and they wanted a more reasonable settlement, and furthermore, they wanted the more reasonable settlement out of the pockets of the jurors, who are the very people that are the rate payers. Now, it used to be in this country that those people sitting on the jury in 1950 could put two and two together, and they deliberated, and they said, now, wait a minute, what are these ladies after? They want twice as much money. We think that $500,000, which in today's dollars would be equivalent to $5 million, we think that is very, very fair. And maybe their husbands were worth $1 million each, but we kind of don't think so. Now, think about this. In 1950, these two men working, somebody's going to write me a letter and say, well, you can't put a price on somebody's life. Yes, you can. We do it every day. These two men working in 1950, if they were making $3,000 a year, they were in the top 5%, well, the top 25% of income earners in the country. If they were making $10,000 a year, they'd be in the top 5%. Remember today, the top 5% is 100,000. From 50 to today, 60 years, it's about 10 times greater. So that's about where they would be, $10,000 a year. Let's suppose that they're 30 years old and they're going to work for 35 more years. $10,000 times 35 years is $350,000. They have offered these two women $150,000 more than their husbands were ever going to earn in their lifetimes. Can you see why the jury thought that was pretty fair? These two ladies could have put $500,000 in the bank. And in those days, we were getting paid 2.5% interest. 500,000 times 0.025 is $20,000 a year. $20,000 a year. A mailman in those days got paid $3,000 a year. Can you see that? $3,000, $3,600, $4,000, $5,000 a year was skilled labor. $10,000 a year would put you in the top 5% in the nation. They could have put the $500,000 in the bank, taken 2.5% interest, $20,000 a year for the rest of their lives and never depreciated their $500,000 award. They didn't want that, so they ended up with $1. Now learn a lesson from that, because sometimes juries award too much and the courts or the appellate courts knock the award out. Or you come in there and the jury listens to you and says, we think you're greedy, selfish, and we are going to knock that award down. We're going to award you $1. So just tuck that one away in your heart. It's worth remembering. Now, under ordinary circumstances, the insurance industry as a whole rigs the game so that you lose. You lose. And there's a story that comes out of Hurricane Katrina down on the Gulf Coast. When you're living in an area that is subject to hurricanes or tornadoes like I am now, this is Tornado Alley, and so oftentimes we're encouraged to buy tornado insurance. And if you're down on the Gulf Coast, you're encouraged to buy hurricane insurance. If you're in California, you should buy earthquake insurance, and so on down the line. Well, the people in California are at risk of having an earthquake. Here, we don't have them, so who's going to buy earthquake insurance here? Nobody. So the only people that are going to buy earthquake insurance are those that live in an earthquake area where they're likely to have an earthquake and cause damage, and so it costs you an arm and a leg, which is why most people do not buy earthquake insurance in an earthquake area, and people don't buy hurricane insurance in a hurricane area because it's so expensive. Now, in some cases, the bank, in order to issue a mortgage, will require that you buy the hurricane insurance. Now, the insurance company writes the contract. This is an adhesion contract, a take-it-or-leave-it deal, in which the insurance company has all the time in the world to sit there and play with the words and to word the contract just exactly so that it appears that we're giving you the world when in reality we're giving you nothing and taking a bunch in return. And these hurricane insurance policies about clause number 18 will have a clause in there that says we don't pay for water damage. Now 90% of the damage that's done in a hurricane is done by water. Only 10% is done by wind. So what they're saying then in a hurricane policy, if the hurricane blows your house away, we'll pay for it. If the hurricane creates a wave that comes in and washes your house away, we don't pay for it. Well, what caused this wave to come in and wash your house away? Well, it was the hurricane. When the salesman comes and sells you the policy, he tells you verbally that this policy is going to do all these wonderful things for you. And you believe him because in some cases he's actually reading right out of the contract. But he never reads Clause 18. But he reads the clauses in the contract that are going to pay in spades. Makes you feel real good. So he doesn't tell you all of the truth, but he tells you the gospel truth concerning everything that he's telling you. So when he tells you that if the wind comes and blows your house away, we're going to pay you in spades. That's what you wanted to hear. But he doesn't tell you if a wave comes caused by the hurricane, we're not going to pay you jack diddly squat. Now, armed then with half the truth, you buy the policy and you pay your premiums. In many cases, you pay your premiums for 10, 20, 30 years because these hurricanes don't come every other day, you know. They just come once in a blue moon. And so here comes the hurricane, like Hurricane Katrina, and the water damage now washes your house away. And so you go to the insurance company and you say, well, here's my damage, and I want you to pay. And so the adjuster comes out. I'm the adjuster. I'm, you know, just doing my job. And I look at their damage, and then I come to a conclusion. I say, well, it's pretty obvious here that the wave came in from the ocean and then hit your house on this side of the frontage road and washed your house a half a mile away. And we can see that you're totally wiped out, and all that's left is some concrete here on your lot. We know that your house was here the day before Katrina hit, and the day after Katrina hit, your house is gone. And furthermore, we don't have any evidence that your house was blown down 5 minutes before the wave washed over your property, which is what you have to prove. Because Clause 18 says, we don't pay for water damage. We don't pay for floods. Now, if you wanted flood insurance on top of this, they price that clear out in space. So that's why most people don't buy flood insurance, but they buy hurricane insurance. And here in the Midwest, where we have tornadoes, if your house is blown down with a straight line wind, we don't pay. it has to be torn down, it has to be destroyed by a funnel cloud. So we have spotters out here. When the Weather Bureau says, hey, we think we're going to have tornadoes, here comes a thunderstorm through here, and the thunderstorm knocks down a tree, the tree falls into your house and causes $10,000 worth of damage. You don't get paid. Now, you bought this because you said, well, I live in Tornado Alley, thunderstorms come through here, we have strong winds, and they blow things down. 90% of the damage here in the Midwest does not come from the funnel clouds, it comes from the straight line winds. What you see on television around the country, when you see a tornado coming down on Oklahoma City and they show you the pictures and they show you all the damage, yeah, now you've got a bona fide tornado, and the bona fide tornado was seen by spotters, and the tornado ripped your house down, and we're going to pay you like a slot machine. Now, in Oklahoma City, to give you an illustration, since it's in a tornado zone, a lot of people buy it, and they buy it from all over the city. The tornado only hits an area about, you know, maybe a quarter of a mile wide if it's a big tornado, maybe only 300 yards wide or 300 feet wide. And when they show you the damage, boy, it's great. It's total. It just wipes out houses. But what they don't show you is the thousands of houses that weren't touched. It only hits one house out of 100. And the insurance company makes out like a bandit because they're only going to pay one out of 100, which is well within their budget. So there's no problem there. But all of the people who suffer damage from straight-line winds, which causes about 90% of the damage here in the Midwest, from thunderstorms that you never see anywhere else in the country. Nobody comes out here and takes pictures of the damages done to roofs and the trees that are knocked over into houses that are caused by thunderstorms that didn't produce a funnel cloud. They just knocked it down with a straight-line wind without a funnel cloud, and you don't get paid a dime. And they don't tell you that when they're selling you the policy. All right, so let me tell you how you have to deal with that. You need to learn how to read a contract. You don't have to go to law school to learn how to read a contract. They're written in English. What you do have to have is a 10-power loop, because they write these contracts in small print, which is your first clue that you're in the process of being screwed. When somebody hands you a piece of paper that has print that's so small you can't read it, it should send you a signal. This guy wants me to sign a contract that I can't read. He doesn't want me to know what it says. He wrote this contract and doesn't want me to know what he wrote. You should get real suspicious real fast. Nobody does, but I would submit to you that you should. So mull that one over a little bit and see if that makes some sense while I give you a reminder that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives, and it can all be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, and then you can turn to our archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there at georgegordon.org on our archives page. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. We need to keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and editorial review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, they're mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Or you can call us at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about understanding limited liability. Limited liability is insurance. Most of us have insurance of one kind or another, and We buy insurance because we're fearful. Fear is the motivator for insurance. Remember, we have vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. So they come to you and they say, oh my God, your house is going to blow away if you don't have tornado insurance. So we go down and buy it. Hey, you're going to die if you don't have life insurance. Hey, you're going to have a wreck. It's going to cost you $1 million if you don't have collision insurance on your automobile, and so on down the line. So we go ahead and buy these insurance policies, which are actually bets. It's a bet. So I'm going to tell you a little story over here about how these bets work. Up in Boise, Idaho, there was an issue came up concerning fire insurance. So I did a little research project up there, and I got the information together, and here's what I discovered. The last time that a house burned to the ground in Boise, Idaho was in 1957. Burned to the ground. In all other cases, they get out there and they put the fire out before the house burns to the ground. Most fires are what we call grease fires, kitchen fires. They cause a lot of smoke, cause a lot of damage. But the average grease fire back in those days was running about $14,000. And house prices in those days were running about, $50,000 to $100,000, something on that order. If you had a $100,000 house in those days, that was a pretty big splashy house. 50 was pretty splashy. 35 was about average. 50,000 pretty splashy. 100,000 real splashy. And in this research project over here, which I had to report back to the Barristers Inn Roundtable on Tuesday, I discovered that in my neighborhood, I was up on the first bench, four blocks from Joe Albertson, from Albertson Supermarket fame. Okay, I was four blocks from Joe, and my house was about a $100,000 house. We were kind of splashy up there on the first bench. And the fire insurance and so on that house was about $500 a year. Now, if you carry full coverage insurance, that is, I believe my house is going to burn to the ground, you'd have to have $100,000 worth of coverage, and that would cost you $500 a year. And if you had a $14,000 fire, you got to pay your deductible, which is $500, and then they'll pay you a check for $13,500. Now, if you got smart and you said, well, I know what I'll do. I won't buy $100,000 coverage. I'm just going to buy $14,000 in coverage. So that instead of paying $500 a year, I'm only going to pay 14% of $500. $70 would be the number. Well, they wouldn't sell it to you for $70, but they might sell it to you for $170 or something like that. And you're saying, well, I'm going to pay less premium, and I'll take less deductible, and I'm going to have a $14,000 fire when this happens because the fire department's going to come put the fire out. Here's what's going to happen to you. You got $14,000 worth of coverage, and you have a $14,000 grease fire, and they will pay you 14% of the $1,400 less your deductible. Now, why is that? Well, that's because the schedule in the contract is written up and worded in such a way that you have to carry full coverage on your house in order for you to get payment. And if we determine that your house is worth $100,000 and you've only got it covered for $50, then we'll only pay you 50 cents on the dollar. I know you're sitting there aghast. These are clauses that are written up in your insurance contract. These clauses are not explained to you by the insurance agent. If he were to tell you that, you probably wouldn't buy. So he tells you what you want to hear. That's what a salesman is hired to do. A salesman tells you what it is that you want to hear. He does not tell you what you need to know. This is caveat emptor. What you need to do is to read the contract and then decide, well, do I want to buy this? Now, one time I wanted to test this with a insurance agent, and I called him and I said, I want you to come out here and sell me a life insurance policy. And he came out and he told me all about it, and he told me what a great insurance policy this was. And I said, now give me a copy of the policy before I buy it. And he said, well, you can't do that. You have to be qualified first. You have to go down, take a physical, and then you make your application, and then we'll decide whether we want to accept you, and then we'll tell you what the premium is going to be, and then we'll send you a copy of the policy after you've paid your premium. Let's try this shoe on the other foot. Let's suppose you went down to a car dealer, and you said, I would like to test drive this car. And he says, oh, no, you cannot test drive the car. In fact, you cannot even see this car until you've been qualified and approved. You have to go out on our test track, and you have to drive around our test track over there in your car with our examiner, and if we determine that you're competent and qualified to drive, and after we have examined your books and records to see if you're competent and qualified to make our payments, then we will take your money, sign the contract, and 6 weeks later, you will get the car. Then you can inspect it until your heart's content, after you're committed, after you've already paid for it. Would you buy a car from a dealer like that? Well, that's the way you buy insurance. Now, that's why I've said before, if you people ever read these contracts, you wouldn't sign them. Well, if your IQ was anywhere above the speed limit, you wouldn't sign them. Same thing goes with credit cards, guardian-ward relationship in which they write the contract and determine how much they want to charge you. And they've got clauses in there that say if we decide we want to double the interest, we can do that. We don't have to give you any prior notice. We can wait until you've buried yourself in debt and then double your interest rate. All right, now that being the case then, shouldn't you be wary then of signing these contracts with these guardians, placing yourself and your power of attorney under the status of a ward? Now, you can read these. You need to have these glasses. If you'll go into your local coin store, tell the guy in the coin store you'd like to have a 10-power loop that fits around your head. It's a, they may not have them. My coin store had it, and I bought it. I think I paid $30 for it. It's a 10-power loop, and you strap it on your head, kind of like a doctor, you know, has that thing on his head with the light in it. And then it's like a visor. It goes up and down, and you can flip it down. I call it my contract reading glasses, and I can read really fine print. And I don't wear glasses. My eyes are 20/20, but I cannot read the fine print in an insurance contract, so I have to have this 10-power loop, and I've got it. Now I can read it. I sit here, and I read these contracts, and then I start crossing the words out and writing new ones in. And so anyway, this guy, when I told him I wanted to read the contract, you know, before, this is the insurance salesman now, he said, no, you can't do that until after. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, if you can get me the contract before I sign up, I'll buy it. But if you can't, I'm not going to. And, you know, he left and he was saddened. He didn't make a sale, wasted his evening. He was really bummed out because I insisted on reading the terms and conditions before I bought it. See how crazy that is? I'm a peculiar person. I want to read the contract before I sign up. That is not the American way, but that's the way I am. Now, getting back here to the fire insurance story, let me give you a little illustration here, what I'm talking about. You buy this fire insurance, and what you're really betting on here is I'm betting my house is going to burn down. Because if the house doesn't burn down, the insurance company keeps the premium, and I don't get anything. So when I pay my premium, my position is the house is going to burn down, and if it burns down to the ground, you're going to write me a check for $100,000, which is 2-to-1 odds. In other words, I'm going to bet a $500 bill that my house is going to burn to the ground, and you're going to pay me $100,000 if it does. But you're not going to pay me anything, and you're going to keep the $500 if it doesn't burn. Now, that's a bet, and it's a 200-to-1 odds bet. And so I pay my premium, and I sit patiently by for 365 days, and darn, my house doesn't burn down. The insurance company takes the $500, comes back and says, well, would you like to bet that your house is going to burn down this year? Keeping in mind that if you deliberately burn it down, they'll put you in prison if they can catch you. So that keeps you honest. You don't want to burn your own house down. And so you're hoping that your house will catch on fire. You're hoping there's a lightning strike or that there's a wire that shorts out in the panel, or, you know, the electric panel, and burns your house to the ground. Now, you put this second bet up, $500, and you wait, and sure enough, the house doesn't burn. So you're saddened again. So you bet again the third year, $500. And sure enough, your wife, she's cooking on the stove. She gets a grease fire cooking over there. You tell her, get out of the house. I'll call the fire department. And you call the fire department, and the fire department rushes over there, puts the fire out, and your house doesn't burn to the ground. It just suffers a $14,000 damage. Now, how come you got a fire department over there? Well, you're paying $500 a year in property tax, aren't you? And the $500 a year that you're paying in property tax is so that you can pay to have a fire department 4 blocks away, so that if you have a fire, you can call the fire department, and they'll rush over and put the fire out so that you can't collect your $100,000, which is what you're betting the $500 on 200-to-1 odds with the insurance company for. Now, wait a minute. Hang on here a second. On the one hand, you're paying $500 to the insurance company, and then you're paying $500 to the city of Boise, and you're saying to the fire insurance company, hey, I'm going to bet you 200-to-1 odds and $500 my house is going to burn to the ground, but just to make sure that I can't collect on my bet, I'm going to pay $500 to the city to send a fire engine over here to put the fire out so that I can't collect. You know, that would be like getting on a crap table, putting your bet down on the pass line, and then taking a pair of dice that cannot you cannot possibly throw a 7 or 11. Doesn't have any combinations that'll throw a 7 or 11. Huh? What do you think of that? Kind of insane, isn't it? Well, that's what you're doing. So it asks or begs the question, well, what in the hell are you buying fire insurance for? Doesn't that sound kind of working at cross purposes for what you want to do? Now, there's another little part to the story over here. Sometimes, you know, we get funny little stories that come into play, and I'll tell you a little story here. There was a shipload of sardines came into New York Harbor, came in from Norway. And the guy on the ship, you know, the captain, he comes down to Gangplank. He walks over here on the docks, and he says, hey, got any brokers around here? And the guy walks up and says, yeah, I'm a broker. And he says, I've got a whole shipload of sardines out of Norway, and I want to sell the whole shipload of sardines over here for 5 cents a can. And then the broker goes on board, takes a look at the boxes, takes a look at the packaging, and he says, God, these really look good. And he says, how much you got on here? And he says, well, I got 1,000 cases of them. And he says, listen, I'll take the whole 1,000 cases, put them in the warehouse over there, and he writes him a check for 5 cents a can. And then the ship captain gets on his boat and steams out and goes back to Norway. Now the broker has these sardines. He calls a jobber, and he says, hey, I've got a warehouse full of sardines over here, and I'm selling them for 10 cents a can. The jobber comes over, looks at them, inspects the packaging, and says, God, these are really good. Came out of Norway. I like this. And writes him a check for the 10 cents a can. And he goes out, and he calls a wholesaler in. And the wholesaler says, I like them. And he inspects them real good, and he writes out a check for 20 cents a can, and pays the jobber. And the wholesaler calls the retailer, that Safeway and Company, and he says, hey, I got these sardines here, and I'm looking for 40 cents a can, about half price. And the retail buyer comes out, and he takes a look at them, and he says, God, they look really good. He said, but before I buy, I'd like to open a can and then taste it. And so they did. They opened a can. He spit it out. He said, oh, my God, these sardines are so salty, you can't eat them. And the wholesaler looked at the retailer, and he said, why, these sardines aren't for eating. These sardines are for buying and selling. Now, boys and girls, insurance is just about like those sardines. The insurance isn't there to compensate you for a damage. Insurance is there so that we can collect premiums. We're not here to pay out claims. If you think insurance companies are there to pay out claims, you know, you must believe that business is in business for the purposes of providing employment to employees. That's preposterous. Businesses do not exist to employ people. If we had our druthers, we wouldn't employ anybody, period. We only employ people at the last resort. If there's just absolutely no other way that we can do it, then we might employ somebody, but other than that, we're not here to employ people. And insurance companies, if we have to pay, we will. But if there's any way that we can get away from it, we're going to. In fact, as a claims adjuster, I was trained that we never pay a claim on time. Never, 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 never pay a claim on time. You stall the claim out as long as possible. And it's because of what we call the average daily balance. So let's suppose that we owed you, let's say, $10,000. Now, we have a thing here called the average daily balance, and the insurance company has your money invested, and we're collecting 10% per annum. Now, that's what the insurance industry targets. They want 10%. And so they're investing this money at 10%. $10,000 times 0.10 is $1,000 a year. It's divided by 360 days, which is $2.77 a day. If I pay you today, we lose control of the $10,000. You've got it, and that's the end of the transaction. But if I don't pay you, if I call you on the phone and I say, now look, Bob, when you filled out your claim, you made a mistake and you had an omission and it's been rejected and sent back. Come into my office so that we can fill this claim out and make this, you know, correct this error. Now, you in good faith come into my office and you say, well, I'm sorry I made this mistake. What did I do? And I say, well, look right here on this form. See, you didn't fill this out, or you put in this number and blah, blah, blah. And so we fill out the new form and we send it in. Now, it takes 30 days to process your claim. Meanwhile, during this 30-day period, we're making $2.77 a day times 30 days. And we got $83 of this $10,000 in our pockets, don't we? So we still have control of the $10,000. Plus, we have $83.10. So if I could do this for 90 days, now the first thing is you can't collect for 90 days, so we're going to get times three. We're going to get $250 out of our $10,000 coming right out of the chute. Now, if I could stall this off for another month, 2 months, 3 months, who knows? And then I might make another $250. Now, you might be sitting there saying, yeah, but that's only $250 out of $10,000. Hey, listen, insurance companies deal in millions of dollars. And they have what they call a reserve requirement. So the insurance company will have $10, $20, $30, $50 million on reserve that they can't use and can't touch. It's in the bank, and they have a special deal with the bank to pay them interest on. And they don't want to give you your money. They don't want to have to put up any more reserve. And if they keep paying out of their reserves, they got to keep putting more money in it. So the reserve money is dead to start with. So the longer we keep this dead money there, the longer we can keep our real money working at 10%. So let's take $10 million and see what happens. And if you got $10 million sitting out here, times 0.10 divided by 360. Now we're making $2,777 a day times 30 days. All of a sudden, that's $83,333 times 3 months. That's $249,999.99. That's 250 grand. That's a quarter of a million. Hey, we're starting to talk about some real money now. And that's just one more trick out of many, many tricks that insurance companies use in order to maximize their profits. Under the Haslett rule, you remember the Haslett rule? I've mentioned it here a time or two. Mrs. Haslett was a doctor, and the insurance company owed her $5,000, and she put in her claim, and the insurance company refused to pay her. She sued. She collected her $5,000. But she also collected, I forgot how much it was now, but it was a couple $300,000 in punitive damages, and it gave rise to what's known as the Haslett rule. And under the Haslett rule, you can sue for punitive damages of any amount if you can fulfill these 12 rules, a 12-part test. And the reason that the court came down with this Haslett rule was because it was an egregious ripoff. The insurance company had put together a computer program, and they figured out that when they owe you $5,000, it's going to cost you $5,000 to hire a lawyer to come collect it, and so most people won't do that. So if they don't pay those claims, let's take $1,000, $5,000 claims, 100 people will move to get their claims and sue, and we'll have to pay, and we're going to lose big time, so we'll lose 100 people, $10,000, so we lose $1 million. But we got 1,000 people over here that didn't collect $5,000, and that's $50 million, and so we make $45 million by not paying those claims. And they were just raking in money hand over fist. And so the court came down, and they said, wait a minute, we're going to put an end to that. Here's our new rule on punitive damages. They had that thing worked out to around, $8,000, $9,000 per claim. They wouldn't pay you a dime, not a dime. And it's for that reason that insurance is a ripoff. And that's just the tip of the iceberg, boys and girls. We're going to talk about cases and cases and cases that have come down over the years where the insurance companies have been brought up short, but also cases and cases and cases where the insurance company is making a mint off of you and me because of our ignorance, being cunningly coerced into waiving our rights due to our ignorance. Hey, I'm about out of time. I'm going to have to give you a final reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in, around the world in 120 countries daily over the internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and the law hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the law hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives. All of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these law hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.